This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont's golden domed state house sits nestled into the hillside in Montpelier. Its six large granite columns and the statue of agriculture looking down could seem imposing, but this morning when I passed by, the huge heavy doors in the middle were swung wide open, and it's one of the very few, if not the only, state houses that doesn't have metal detectors and is simply open to the public to waltz in and wander around. If you do walk in and you run your hands along the interior walls, it's hard not to think about all the history those walls and the life-sized, maybe larger-than-life, paintings of former governors have witnessed. Like this recent historical moment, a vote in 2009 that led to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Those voting yes, 100. Those voting no, 49. 100 needed to pass. You have voted to override the veto. The House will come to order.
That was House Speaker Shap Smith announcing the results of the vote to override Governor Jim Douglas's veto of the same-sex marriage bill. Just one of so many important moments in Vermont history that have been created within the confines of the State House. Today on the program, we're going to go deep into the history of that building and the two buildings that preceded it. Author and historian Nancy Price Graff and state curator David Sheets have just published a book chronicling the interesting facts, features, and stories of the Vermont State House. The book is called Intimate Grandeur, and Nancy and David join me now. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jane.
And Nancy, a special thanks to you for speaking today. I know that you've been ill, so we won't mind if you're a little quieter than normal. So let's talk first a little bit, just briefly, about what the State House looks like. Paint a picture in people's minds who may not be quite as intimately familiar with the building as the two of you are. David, you've spent so much time there. Please share.
Indeed. Well, happily, the State House does not look completely the way it did when I arrived 37 years ago for a project that kicked off many things, including the actual restoration of that building. And today, I'm happy to say it's a building that once again looks pretty much the way it did in the middle of the 19th century, thanks to that restoration, but also thanks to good old-fashioned Vermont frugality, which meant that they didn't replace the furniture. We have 90% of the original furniture from 1859 still in that building. And today, of course, it has carpets and drapes and all of the things, of course, that wear out over time that now look just as they did as well. And those are naturally the things that fall away inevitably over the life of a building. And today, as well, we seem to have embraced a new life for the State House. Back then, it was not a building that was particularly acknowledged to be a museum. And yet, it had had visitors in huge numbers that continue to be among the largest crowds of any attraction in the entire state. And that's, of course, by virtue of it having a golden dome. Put a gold dome on a building and they will come. So we don't need billboards when you have gold domes. So that's the life of the State House that, frankly, it has always had. But happily, in the last 30 years, we've managed to turn back the clock a bit in terms of the look of the place. And we've also ramped up its interpretation to the visiting public. It's a building today that is interpreted to visitors in a wide variety of ways. Our tour guides actively seek out what visitors are after on a typical visit to the State House, and they have their tourist, routine, but they also have the largest group of Vermont school children in the state, an audience that we take very seriously that is acclimated to the building in a much deeper way by suggesting that it's the greatest learning laboratory for civics that we have in Vermont. And that openness that you're talking about, Jane, that remarkable accessibility where we in this state can enjoy lawmakers who we know as our neighbors and actively connect kids and their parents to what's going on in that building. That's one of our most important missions, along with the private nonprofit organization that was formed 30 years ago, the Friends of the Vermont State House, who are our active partners in bringing all of this about, including the book, as publishers of Intimate Grandeur.
You mentioned David Kids, and we got a note from Julie who says, our family appreciates the accessibility that we have to our state house in Vermont. Not only is it a gorgeous structure to tour full of rich history, but my children have also been able to learn firsthand about our state legislature and governmental process. And in her note, Julie attached a photo of the state house that her then 9-year-old daughter had drawn in sidewalk chalk. So it's a photo of the sidewalk chalk drawing after a visit 2 years ago. And we've put that on our Facebook page for anybody who wants to see an interpretation of the state house as we're thinking about that building today.
I love it.
Nancy, Tom Slayton writes in the foreword of this book that the state house was cramped and crowded because of its size from the very beginning. Why then is it so small? Why not make it bigger? The dome is about half the height of many state houses in the country.
Governors and legislatures have showed amazing restraint over the years because there has been pressure on the building to expand almost from the day it opened. People didn't have enough office space, or there were times when there were 60 standing committees and they needed meeting space. And yet, whenever someone proposed expanding the state house, thoughtful deliberation followed, and there was an addition put on in the late 1880s to the rear west left side of the state house, a small addition on the back, and into the 20th century, the addition for the cafeteria on the back of the building. But people generally deeply appreciated the beauty and symmetry of the building and did not want to mess it up.
You know, David alluded to the access and the openness of the building. And when you walk through the State House, you pretty quickly realize there are not a lot of offices. I mean, as David mentioned with the restoration, this does not look very modern in any way, but also not very modern-like. It doesn't have offices. There are a couple. There's the executive chambers. There's an office for the Senate President Pro Tem. But by and large, there are the big chambers, and then there are committee rooms. And these committee rooms are often open. And so people don't have small offices. They sort of have to work collaboratively. They have to work out in public if they're going to be in the State House building. And I'm curious, actually, from both of your perspectives, whether it was built that way because Vermont government has always been this sort of collaborative, open process, or is that collaboration and lack of privacy a function of the building itself? You know, does the State House in some way contribute to Vermont democracy and government inaction?
Most assuredly. It is a very compact and intimate building. That was one of our main premises from the outset, is that it speaks volumes about this state, not necessarily any other state. That's what state capitals do at their very best, is that hopefully they exemplify the characteristics of the state they serve. And we're saying in Intimate Grandeur, that's exactly what it does. You are steps away from one another. In most behemoth state capitol buildings, I say that with a little scorn, as you can tell, they have whole wings devoted to the House and the Senate and the executive branch, and the judicial branch as well.
And although we should say these are sort of the ceremonial chambers for the governor in the State House. The governor does have a separate office where he and his
staff
work.
That's correct. He still has his presence in the State House in the historic context of that room that has always served Vermont governors. But he's literally steps away from all lawmakers, even the committee rooms, which are now in two locations, the House in that wing that Nancy was talking about that was built in the 1880s, and the Senate down in what used to be the constitutional officers' offices. And it's still very tight quarters, And that has made for very success, for excellent lawmaking, in my humble opinion, because they're forced to deal with one another in these close quarters. The other thing is, no offices is right down there with the citizen-based premise that our legislature happily still enjoys, with increasing professionalization, which is not necessarily a bad thing in lawmaking or in government. That has not pushed us into the era where they all have to have offices. They enjoy only the desks in those chambers and their committee rooms as workspace. And
those desks tight. In the chambers, I want to point out for people who don't have an intimate knowledge of this, are much like you might remember desks from childhood and from school, in that they sort of open up and lawmakers can stuff things in there and keep their notes and keep their piles. And they do get assigned a desk so they can keep their stuff in there, much like the cubbies of yore.
And they're tiny. And they're heaped with paperwork. You know, for a neatnik curator, it can be a little troubling. But I also recognize what makes our state house really unique is the fact that 156 years later, they are using the oldest legislative chambers in the United States that are in their original condition and still in active use in the 21st century. And if we want to be proud of that, I have to, you know, be okay with piles of papers all over the place. Happily, too, in the digital age, they now use tablets. These have been assigned to almost all lawmakers. And that is definitely cutting down on the paper in the building, which has been a real virtue of the last decade or so.
Nancy, let me ask you, though, as
well,
we build
I just
on this.
I want to point out, though, that when the State House was built in 1859 and opened, state office holders did not spend their time at the State House.
That's right.
They worked from home. So they only needed an office that would carry them through the legislative session, which then was in the fall. So for maybe a month, they needed a room 10 by 10. And the rest of the year, nobody was there. It wasn't until during the Civil War, which wasn't all that many years later, that the state had two full-time offices open, Adjutant General and the paymaster or something like that for the soldiers, right?
General.
Quartermaster general. And it was still several decades later when a governor, and I forget who it was, said, okay, you guys aren't working from home anymore. You're going to come and work in Montpelier and you're going to clock in regular hours like the people who work for you do. And, you know, that seemed like a horrible imposition on people who were used to working at home in their, you know, moving from their kitchen to their study for their workday. So the building was not built with the idea that people would have offices in it 12 months a year and be working in it from 7:45 to 4:30 every day.
But Nancy, do you think now that the building shapes the way our legislature behaves because they are confined within it?
Absolutely. I think everybody having to share a small space is a good experiment in social behavior that's worked for the Vermont legislature.
And the other thing that drives that is the session's length of time. They're keenly aware that Vermonters don't expect them to be in Montpelier all that long. And I think that goes back to that time. I think Vermonters have never lost sight of the fact that a legislative session is supposed to be only so long. And even today, they feel that pressure in the State House, and they know they have to deal with it within that time frame.
That's true. We're talking today about the State House, the Vermont State House, and we're talking a little bit about how the building works, what's in it. We're going to look a little bit at some of the quirks in the building. Did you know the dome used to be red? We're going to talk about some of the other special architectural features and answer your questions. If you've been – maybe you've worked in the State House. Maybe you're a former legislator, current legislator, or somebody else who's got intimate knowledge of the State House. What do you love about it? You can even tell us a little bit about what you perhaps don't love. Or if you have questions, maybe stories that you've heard over the years that you want confirmed or denied. We're talking today about the State House with Nancy Price Graff and David Sheets. Our number, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, I'm talking with Nancy Price Graff and David Sheets. Together with photography from Jeb Wallace Broder, they've created a new book that chronicles the history and lore of the Vermont State House. Nancy and David are sharing some of the stories and the most interesting details of the State House and how it shapes Vermont government with us today. And I'd love to know what questions you have. Maybe you've been in the chambers and looked at those ornate rugs and wondered why they're there, or gazed at the striking mural in the Cedar Creek Room. So what do you want to know from these experts? Call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post questions and thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, where, again, you can see a photo of a 9-year-old's interpretation in chalk of what the State House represents. Marnie in Middlebury says, I've spent many hours in the building and have greatly enjoyed its various aspects. I find the corridor where the commanding bust of Abraham Lincoln resides a special place. I've often placed myself on one of the benches there for some calm reflection in the midst of the building's busy work. The large marble pieces on the walls have quotes that are quite spectacular and very inspiring. The Vermont State House is an amazing treasure, in my view. Lauren in St. Johnsbury emailed in to say, my grandmother was in the legislature in the 1950s and 60s. Sometime during her service, there was an earthquake that jarred the dome enough to result in some of the gold leaf breaking apart and falling off. I had some pieces that she told me she had gathered from the ground near the State House. I'm interested in knowing when this earthquake happened and if there are any other details available. Either of you familiar with an earthquake? I'm getting quizzical looks, Lauren, from our State House experts here.
They certainly happen in Vermont. I've endured a couple very tiny such occurrences. And yes, gold leaf has been retrieved from the State House lawn. It scrapes off all the time because it's on the copper. The original copper sheathing is covering that wooden dome. With a wonderful photograph in the book of the first time, I believe, publicly that we've revealed what the inside of the dome actually looks like, which is totally wood. And that gold leaf comes off. We're getting very close, in fact, to a point at which we think we're going to have to regild sometime soon.
And when the gold leaf comes off, what's underneath?
What's underneath is copper that has, in some cases, you can actually see when you're up close, the original red paint is also under the gold leaf. So dating back to the time when they were very keenly aware that they wanted this State House to look as though it came out of Renaissance Italy. So the red paint is simply trying to imitate the look of a red tile roof that you would find in an Italian city like Florence.
Let's go to Anne, who's calling in from Montpelier, and then, Nancy, I'll let you jump in again. Okay. Anne, go right ahead.
Okay. Hi, David and Nancy. Anne Burcroft. When I first moved to Montpelier 26 years ago, I was buying paint for my house in a store that's now closed, and there was a man in there, and he said to me, do you know who's on top of the State House? And I did know. It was Ceres, the goddess of agriculture, and he went on to say, I shave her. And I said, you what? And he said there were cobwebs around her nose and mouth, so he had to get up there twice a year and wipe away the cobwebs. That was my introduction to our very unique State House.
And thanks for that wonderful story. How cool to have met the man whose job it was to take the cobwebs off Ceres. Nancy, I interrupted you.
I was just going to make two quick points. One is that in case you were wondering, the dome was gilded in 1906 for the first time, and it was red up until then. I'd like to address a comment to the woman from Middlebury about that Hall of Inscriptions. That has always been a very special space in the State House. Immediately after the Civil War, Vermont started collecting small photo portraits of Vermont Civil War officers and building them into these big montages. And so for 70 years or so, that's what filled that hallway on either side. No words, just the faces of men who gave their lives or their health or at least some portion of their manhood to that conflict, which was an incredibly important event in the lives of Vermonters. And when the last Civil War veteran died in 1944, they came down finally, as if we didn't have to honor the soldiers in that way anymore. And inscriptions went up, although inscriptions that are there now are much more modern.
And is one of them yours that you chose?
Yes, I chose the Dorothy Canfield Fisher quotation, and my husband chose the George Aiken quotation, so we both are.
Which is when we restored the Hall of Inscriptions, right, and we created what are more in keeping with the building, mm-hmm, marble tablets rather than the plexiglass versions that came in, mm-hmm, in the early 70s.
David, I sense that you have a lot of disdain for some of the changes that had been made previously in the State House.
Well, yes. I mean, I think what the State House has benefited, as I said, from this desire not to really change it all that much because that would cost money. But but the other thing was that there was an unfortunate modernization of the building in the early 70s. And arguably, had that not occurred, I'm not sure that the group of people that organized in the early 80s would have even been necessary because they were responding to the insensitive way the State House had been modernized a mere 10 years earlier. Up until then, it was remarkably well preserved in that the senators were still sitting in the old horsehair chairs that they had had for over 100 years at that point. And that's pretty remarkable.
We're talking today about Vermont's State House, about the building itself, and then a little bit about some of the things that have happened inside that building and the way the building shapes our sense of Vermont government. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Maybe you remember when the time capsule from 1938 was opened at the beginning of this century and a new time capsule was put in. Maybe you want to share your favorite memories of field trips to the State House or a tour of the State House you did when you first moved to Vermont. You can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. One thing that I didn't realize about the State House that I want to make sure we get in here is that this is the third State House in that spot. There were two previous ones. The first one was a wooden State House that was built at the beginning of the 1800s and then torn down to make way for a newer, bigger State House that was built out of stone. What happened to that State House, though, in 1857? I will have a spoiler here. It caught fire. But the story behind the fire is actually pretty interesting. Nancy?
It was either the janitor or someone who worked for the janitor. It's like blaming it on the butler. No one really wanted to admit guilt. But they were heating up the State House for a constitutional convention meeting in early January of 1857. And whoever was tending the fires in the State House thought the State House would heat up faster if they closed off the cold air returns. And that was done.
That was a bad idea.
That was a bad idea. And that person went home. And pretty much the next thing they knew, all the bells in town were ringing. And it was nighttime. And there was a desperate dash on the part of people from all over Montpelier to save whatever they could of the State House, but it was not enough to rebuild from.
It was sort of a smoldering ruin, as you both describe it in the book.
Yes.
So that's where this state house we have now came from. It was built in 1859 and with a pledge of $100,000, which was a lot of money at the time, from the people of Montpelier. Okay. Although, as you write, I think they only eventually ever gave $15,000 towards it. So.
But they pledged money towards the second state house and they pledged money towards the first state house.
But was that partly to try to keep the state house here? Mm-hmm. Because Burlingtonians
Absolutely.
Have always wanted to bring it up to Burlington.
That was one of the key arguments. And ironically, it was the Burlington Free Press that pointed out to the broader argument that maybe all of the taxpayers in Vermont should be paying for the state house rather than just the citizens of Montpelier. And that's how the amount was reduced.
In arguing that everybody should pay for it, not just the people of Montpelier, there was a line, someone remarked that a gentleman should own his own home. And so the state should own its state house.
Oh, how interesting. I want to give you both a chance to talk about a feature or two that you really love about the state house. You've spent a lot of time thinking about it. VPR's Bob Kinzel wanted me to ask about the stained glass ceiling above the Cedar Creek room. But David Sheets, I know you had a lot to do with that, but maybe that's not the one you want to talk about. But maybe you could briefly.
I think that story, which is frequently discussed by tour guides because it's kind of the end of a typical tour. They're in the Cedar Creek room. They're looking up at all of the late 19th century glory of that room, which sets it a bit apart from the 1850s rooms of the tour. But the stained glass skylights were nowhere to be found. We didn't even know what they looked like. We knew there had been stained glass up there, but no idea of what it ought to look like. So the charge that the architect, John Misick, had was how would you even replicate if you don't know what to replicate? So happily, in searching the attic above, we did find the glass one piece at a time and then very slowly recognized that they had apparently been thrown aside, shattered into thousands of pieces. And we collected as much of the glass as we could. Sent it down to Massachusetts to a conservator, and for the next 2 years, it was painstakingly pieced together again on big light tables. And the miracle was that somehow, without any idea of what this would eventually look like, we had managed to recover virtually every piece. So happily, that's what's up there. The actual windows, as opposed to somebody's rough idea of what they might look like.
That's so wonderful. Nancy, for you?
Well, I might have talked about this Battle of Cedar Creek by Julian Scott, but then we'd be back in the same room where with the stained windows. So I'm going to go to Hiram Powers' Greek Slaves in the chandelier in the well of the house. Hiram Powers was a Woodstock native, and he became a very famous sculptor, and in the 1840s, he was sculpting finally in stone and marble, and he created an ideal Greek slave. It's a nude woman. Her hands are shackled. She's looking demurely to the side, and she's supposed to be a young Greek woman captured by the Turks. But she was an irritating reminder of slavery and its feelings. Mm-hmm. And although nude statuary was common in Europe, it was much less common in the United States. It was sort of scandalous and outrageous, and men and women weren't allowed to see it at the same time in New York mm-hmm. City. But we have her cast in bronze on the chandelier in the State House.
Four of them. The house chandelier.
Wow. Right. So much to see, so much to think about in the Vermont State House, and so much in this book. It's called Intimate Grandeur, Vermont's State House. We're going to have links to information for people who would like to get the book, because we have really just scratched the surface here today. Beautiful photos as well from Jeb Wallace Broder. Nancy, I'm catching your voice problem here. But Nancy Price Graff, state curator David Sheets, they are the words and voices behind this labor of love, blood, sweat, and tears. Thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you very
much. Thank you so much.
Coming up, we pay a visit to the state's only landfill in Coventry and find out how they contain the smell of the more than 450,000 tons of trash that get dumped there every year. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont has only one operational landfill in the entire state, and it takes more than two-thirds of the 600,000 tons of waste we throw away every year. But most Vermonters have never seen the Coventry landfill, so a few weeks ago I got a tour from Joe Gay. He's an engineer with Casella Waste Systems, which owns and operates the landfill. Okay, so before we get in the car with him to head over to where all of our trash is being dumped, let me just situate you. Coventry is up near the Canadian border, next to Newport and Lake Memphremagog, and the landfill itself is out of town a ways, smack dab next to the Newport Airport, which has been expanding recently. All right, so here's Joe Gay to show us around.
You'll see a lot of landfill fencing as we drive around the perimeter. The landfill fencing keeps litter as best as possible inside the footprint of the landfill. And then certainly anything that gets past the landfill itself is collected. We have a litter patrol that goes around and collects the litter, bags it up, and brings it back to the site. And really, that's only on, you know, windy days. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're operating somewhat down in a hole, so we don't see quite as much litter. But when we're up on top of the landfill and it's windy, we will get litter. In fact, the staff here at the site have the ability to shut the landfill down if the wind is too bad. You know, some wind can generate some litter that'll basically just, you know, become suspended in the wind. And if it was too windy, the operators can shut the incoming flow of waste down, and then they can get what waste is in the landfill covered and wait for another day when it's not as windy.
Covered with what?
So we cover with 6 inches of soil. We have plenty of material here on site to excavate and haul it over to the daily operational area. And at the end of the day, the waste gets covered with 6 inches of soil. At the end of every day. Wow. Yep, that's a requirement by the state regulation. And on several occasions, we will show up in the morning to begin our daily operations, and the state will be waiting at the gate, and they'll want to come in and see how we did the night before.
And now, do you guys bristle when I say trash? Is that an appropriate word?
Sure is. Okay. Yep. Just don't call it a dump. We prefer the word landfill. I think people traditionally, when they hear dump, they think of what they might have remembered as a child growing up, and you know, it's just a lot different now with the containment system and all the regulations that we have, the gas collection and the way we manage the gas off the landfill. It's just very different than what we might remember.
But you were mentioning before we turned the tape on that it may still look to somebody like their old idea of a dump. So it's all of the stuff that's happening sort of either underground or just less visibly that is different.
Right, through regulation and the methods that were required to protect the environment are very, very different. What you see right there, actual waste going in the landfill, is probably going to look a lot like it used to back in the days when we used to go to the dump. And there's far too much recycling still. As we look at the trash coming out of the trucks today, there is way too much recycling that's still coming to this facility needlessly. We've got to do a better job as Vermonters removing the cardboard and removing the plastic bottles and removing the plastics and getting those materials into the waste stream.
So is it frustrating to you to look down and see so much recyclable material still in the landfill?
It's very frustrating, absolutely. When you walk out there, it's almost shameful with the amount of materials that can be going to better uses than being disposed of here at the site. So straight ahead is the daily operations.
Can we get out and...
Absolutely. You know, the wind is coming right at us.
Yeah.
So you know, as the trucks come in, depending upon which type of truck it is, the waste is tipped, and you'll see two large bulldozers. So the dozers do the work. They push the waste to the compactor. The compactor compacts the trash to maximize the overall airspace in the landfill.
How much of a difference does the compacting make? Can you, I mean, I know you don't do it by my trash bag, but how big would my trash bag be after it's been compacted?
Yeah, I would say that your trash bag would be compacted to about 10% of its size.
Wow, so a lot.
A lot, yep.
Tell me where we are right now, if you could map out the landfill.
Mm-hmm. So we're on the eastern side of the facility. So we're looking west to east into the active area of the landfill. In the foreground here, we have an area that we plan to expand the landfill next summer. We have about 4.9 acres left in this end of the landfill, and we will hire a contractor to come in, develop a subgrade, and then we'll lay the various layers of the landfill containment system down to protect the environment from the wastewater that drains down through the trash over time.
And right now, explain how that works, because obviously, you know, you're putting soil down on the trash, but rainwater, snow, all still seeps through and seeps into the trash and the landfill and goes down. So what is the containment system?
Rain will end up at the bottom of the landfill, and in the bottom of the landfill, we have two layers that protect the environment, separated by about 18 inches of soil. The two layers are 60 mil high-density polyethylene. It's a plastic liner, and those plastic liners are welded together across the entire footprint of the landfill. So as the waste is compacted, let's say it was raining today, some of that rain is going to migrate through that trash, pick up some contamination, and then eventually will drain vertically all the way down to the bottom of the landfill. And in that low spot, that wastewater will accumulate, and then we pump that wastewater out of the landfill and haul that wastewater to a wastewater treatment facility. And that leachate is treated through the process at the wastewater treatment plants and managed that way.
There appears to be a pretty large gang of marauding seagulls hanging out at the trash. Not surprising. You know, I think people probably picture seagulls at the dump. But that's a problem for the airport?
It is a problem for the airport. So we have a full-time USDA staff person here. His job is to manage the gulls as well as crows to minimize the risk of bird to airplane collision. And while we're looking in there, I'm seeing 20 or 30 gulls. I got to believe at some point here fairly soon we're going to see the bird management specialist show up and scare those birds off.
So how does he scare them off?
Pyrotechnics. We call them shot crackers. They're like a bottle rocket that scares the birds. Just the fact that he drives the same pickup truck, when these gulls see the gentleman pull up in his pickup truck, they take off because they know he's the guy. And the gulls are smart enough to know the difference between his vehicle and others' vehicles.
No kidding.
That's a fact. Yep.
So you mentioned that the wind is blowing right at us, and you can smell a little bit of what smells like a typical trash can or trashy smell, but it's mild. So is this pretty typical for what you'd smell around the site?
Yes, it is. I would expect to catch a little bit of odor as we're standing here. We certainly try to minimize any impact on the neighborhood with odors. One of the reasons why we cover the trash at the end of the night. And we have upwards of 200 collection points around the landfill. And when I say around the landfill, I'm talking about pipes inside the garbage that have a vacuum applied to them. And so that vacuum is harnessing the gas, and that gas is ending up down at the energy plant where the gas is being utilized as a renewable source to create power. And that facility down there is producing about 8 megawatts of power when it's at full capacity. And there goes one of the shot crackers. There's the bird guy right there. Told you he'd be showing up.
Yeah, that startled me.
And you can see the gull starting to take off.
So you were saying the odors and the methane that is trapped. So if those vacuum tubes were not pulling that methane out of the landfill, would it smell more?
Yes, it definitely would. Without the gas collection system here at the facility, we would have some very significant odor issues. This landfill would be smelled down in the city of Newport. It would be noticed by our surrounding neighbors. You can imagine, you know, we have nearly 70 acres of waste here at this facility, and without the gas collection system, there would be some significant impacts with odors in the community. And not to mention that there would also be greenhouse gas impacts. So landfill gas is an ozone depleter, and by harnessing the gas, not only are we controlling the odors and reducing the impacts to the neighborhood, but we're also reducing impacts to global warming as well.
Are you seeing yet any effects of the mandatory recycling law that's being phased in now in Vermont?
I don't think we're seeing any impacts as we stand here today, but I think over time we will start to see a loss of production of landfill gas by taking the organics out of the waste stream. That is the primary component by which the landfill gas is generating methane. And long term, I think we probably will not realize as much gas production as we had initially expected and hoped for, you know, for the energy plant.
So that's the composting, the mandatory composting piece of this new law that, again, is being phased in. Eventually it will come to households where each individual household will be expected to compost their organic matter or send their organic matter to a place where it can be composted. Do you see less material coming into the facility than before people were made aware of recycling laws and before recycling became mandatory?
You know, over the last couple of months, we have seen a drop in our waste acceptance here at the facility. So if that's an indication of the new regulation, I think the state is definitely heading in the right direction. While we're coming out of the construction season, which is one of our busier times for disposal rates, we do think that the overall waste acceptance rate is down over what we have historically seen.
Nonetheless, in the time that you and I have been talking, I mean, I haven't actually been counting, but I would estimate maybe 6 or 7 large full trucks have pulled in to drop off waste, and the same number have, you know, pulled out again. So it still looks like it's quite a busy facility you've got here.
It is a busy facility. There's no question about it. And, you know, when we stop and think about all that we throw away, we are the only operating landfill in the state. And so, you know, we are seeing a large portion of the state's waste. And when it comes to municipal solid waste, you know, the routine garbage, you know, we do not take that type of waste from out of state. So what you're seeing is Vermont-generated waste. The state of Vermont produces upwards of 600,000 tons a year. And we take about 450,000 tons of that. So we are taking a large percentage of what is generated across the state.
That was Casella Waste Systems engineer Joe Gay showing us around the active part of the landfill in Coventry. That's the state's only operational landfill, and Joe says he thinks it could operate for another 30 or 35 years if they get the permits they need for expansion. We'll post a little video of what the landfill looks like up on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. It's time for our mailbag when we read your comments and emails. Vermont Edition executive producer Patty Daniels is here. Hey, Patty.
Hey, Jane. We got a lot of feedback on our show recapping last week's Democratic presidential debate. Here's just a couple of those comments. Anne says she's been a supporter of Bernie Sanders for years, but she writes, "It's difficult to look past how impressed I am with Hillary Clinton. I think it's easily forgotten how she made it in what was previously and still very much is a man's world. She's accomplished a tremendous amount, and it's hard not to admire her for it."
Patricia in Newport also chimed in on the debate. She says, "What if Bernie had not been participating? Think about what that debate would have been like. He's essential to clearly raise issues of our middle class people who are over 50 years old. Many of us have another 40 years to live. How will we pay for that? So glad Bernie got to talk about Social Security."
Last Thursday, we talked about the future of unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones, and what regulation of those drones should look like in Vermont. Here's a comment from Ariella. She says, I think it's a matter of determining the various areas the drones could be used. Each situation, environmental, commercial, law enforcement, hobbyist, there should all be different sets of laws, she says. Permissions should be sought for drone use over private property, and public spaces like concert venues, ski mountains, etc., should institute their own rules for drone usage.
Several people wrote in on that show, Patty, about their anxiety that someone with a drone could be looking in their windows and recording their activities. Michael tried to put that in perspective. You're all flattering yourselves if you think anyone cares to spy on you, he says.
Okay, well, finally, we want to highlight an email that came in from a little farther afield than usual. We got this note from Jennifer. She writes, I wanted to let you know how much I enjoy listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm currently serving as a Peace Corps volunteer in Tanzania, but I'm originally from Middlebury, Vermont. I get access to the internet once every 2 weeks or so, and I always look forward to coming into town so that I can download new podcasts and keep up with my local Vermont news.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm so glad we can keep you up to date on everything that's happening in Vermont. And if any of you anywhere would like to weigh in on our show, post on our website, on Facebook, or write to vermontedition@vpr.net. Thanks, Patty.
You got it.
So that's it for today's show. Tomorrow, we'll sit down with Senator Patrick Leahy. There's a lot happening in Congress these days. We'll get his take on the possibility of a government shutdown, what U.S. policy should be in Syria, and what the senator thinks of the possibility of a new gun control bill. Send your questions for Senator Leahy to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.